probably never even run a red light. Everyone looks up to you.
Hugh met Captain Quant's gaze.
Not everyone. You got no idea what you might do when you feel trapped.
George was retreating into his own defensive armor, making excuses for his behavior and using it to sever the connection that Hugh had built with him. He could continue down this rabbit hole and take all the hostages with him. It would be fast, and it would be bloody, and it would be over. Or, Hugh could say something, do something, that would make George realize he was not stuck, that there was a way out. He stared at Quant, silently begging the man for a grace period, but the SWAT commander took off his headphones and turned to rally his team.
You told me you started this for your daughter, he said to George. Now, end it for her.
3 p.m. Hugh stared at the windows of the clinic, mirrored like aviator sunglasses. He assumed they were a later addition when the protesters grew in number. This gave the women inside a sense that once they crossed the threshold, their business was their business alone. Those windows were meant to protect, but today they were obstacles. No one knew what was happening inside those walls. He glanced at the phone in his hand, the line dead. 1 minute he'd been talking with George, seemingly making progress, and the next he had been disconnected. He dialed again and again, but there was no answer. His heart was racing, and not just because he'd lost contact with the hostage taker. The last sound he'd heard, before George hung up on him, was Ren's voice, which meant, oh fuck, he didn't even want to go there. He opened to the text thread he'd had with his daughter. Ren, he typed, ?. Are you okay? He held his breath, and the three telltale dots appeared. She was responding. She was all right. He sank into the folding chair someone had brought him a couple of hours ago, holding the phone between his hands and willing the response to come faster.
You?
At the sound of Chief Monroe's voice, he slipped his phone beneath a stack of papers. He could not let on that Ren was inside, that he knew Ren was inside. The minute he did, his neutrality was compromised.
Yeah, Chief.
He looked up to see a guy in camo approaching.
This is Joe Quant, the chief said. He's the SWAT commander. Joe, this is Detective Lieutenant Hugh McElroy.
Hugh recognized Quant. They'd worked together before. Quant held out his hand.
Sorry for the delay, he said.
It was not unusual for a countrywide SWAT team to take a bit of time to congregate. The individuals constituting it came from all over the state, and after receiving the call of a crisis in progress, had to converge upon it. Hugh had had 3 hours on his own to manage the situation, but now that Captain Quant had arrived, there would be a struggle to see who would actually be in charge. Hugh immediately began to give a rundown of the past 3 hours. If he acted like he was in charge, maybe it would remain that way.
Have you got aerial photos?
Quant asked, and Hugh nodded. It was one of the first things he'd asked for, so that when the SWAT team needed to get snipers into position, they'd know where to place them. He shuffled through the materials on his command desk, surreptitiously glancing at his phone as he did so. Those dots were still there, but no message yet. ... Dot, dot, dot.
I've already instructed my team to take the perimeter, Quant said.
Hugh knew this was a relief to the chief, who didn't have the manpower to block the clinic entrances, restrict the media, and reroute traffic.
We'll be ready to go in about 15 minutes.
SWAT teams existed to back up the negotiator, but they also itched to do what they were trained for, end the showdown by force. Negotiators wanted to do what they were trained to do, negotiate.
I don't think that's wise. He's got the hostages in the front waiting room, Hugh said, and he can see you coming through the mirrored glass, but you can't see in. We could pump tear gas in.
There are injured people in there, Hugh said, his voice even. And my kid. The chief turned to Hugh.
So what's your plan?
Give Goddard a little more time, Hugh said. Let me figure out what's happening inside first. Let me hear from Wren.
Quant shook his head.
It's my understanding that there were shots fired, but not in the last 3 hours, Hugh pointed out. I've been able to keep him calm.
He looked at Quant.
If you go in, can you guarantee that you won't lose a hostage?
The SWAT team commander's jaw tightened.
Of course not, he said.
Both men turned to Chief Monroe.
Hugh will continue to run with it for now, the chief replied.
Chief Monroe put his hand on Hugh's shoulder, turning him away from the SWAT commander. He spoke in a firm, quiet voice.
You do know what you're doing, don't you?
Yes, sir, Hugh said,
as if hostage negotiation was a set of rules you could follow, rather than a game where the players made up the rules as they went.
I have to get back to. I need to.
He moved to his makeshift desk again and grabbed his phone. There was no message, and the dots were gone, too. He texted again. Wren? When the shooter had yanked open the door to her hiding place, Wren thought her heart was going to burst. She barely managed to hide her phone in her sock before he grabbed her wrist and pulled so hard that she cried out. She managed to claw his face and drew blood, a triumph about which she was supremely happy. He dragged her into the waiting room in the front of the clinic, the one with the windows where you could see out, but people on the street couldn't see in. She landed sprawled on her belly in front of a handful of people. There was a woman in sweats who had freckles all over her face that stood out because she was so pale right now. There was another girl, maybe in her 20s, with a giant bruise on her forehead. The red-headed lady in scrubs, who had opened the closet door earlier and pretended not to see her. The only male hostage rested his head in her lap and was breathing heavily. His own scrubs had been ripped off at the thigh, and below a belt of fabric and tape, his leg was bloodied. Her Aunt Bex was nowhere. Wren felt tears spring to her eyes. Was she dead? Had someone dragged her body into another room? When she was little and her Aunt Bex used to watch her after school while her dad was at work, they did everything Wren wasn't supposed to do. They ate dessert and skipped dinner. They watched R-rated movies. Her aunt had promised that not only would she take Wren to get a tattoo when she was 18, she would design it for her. What if neither of them survived that long?
Tie her hands, the shooter yelled. Now! You!
He jerked the gun at the redhead in scrubs. She took a roll of surgical tape and wrapped it around Wren's wrists. She was trying to do it loosely, but it was tape, and there was no way Wren was getting free anytime soon. Are you hurt? She whispered. I'm a nurse.
I'm okay, Wren managed. My aunt.
The woman with you in the closet? Wren shook her head.
No, the lady who was shot, out here.
Bex, the nurse murmured. She got out. Wren collapsed with relief on an empty couch. Aunt Bex was alive, or at least she had been. She hoped that the next time she saw Bex, her aunt reamed her for putting her in this situation. She hoped that Bex yelled so loud Ren was brought to tears. She wouldn't mind if Bex refused to forgive her for the rest of her life. Just so long as she had a rest of her life. Ren had begged Aunt Bex to bring her here. If she had talked to her dad, maybe they could have made an appointment with a gynecologist. Maybe she would be snagging a lollipop from a basket on her way out. Did gynecologists even have those? Or were they just for pediatricians' offices? Then again, she never could have asked her father. He didn't even let her wear spaghetti straps to school. All he knew about Ryan was that they were working together on a chemistry project. Which was kind of true. But what was combustible was the two of them. Ren thought about the kisses that made her lips feel like they'd been blistered, about how his hand snaked under her shirt and ignited her skin. She thought of the giddy rush of adrenaline that flooded her when they scrambled apart a breath before Ryan's mother opened the door, her arms full of groceries. Had she told her father about Ryan, he would have been waiting on the hairpin turn near the high school to give Ryan a ticket for driving too fast or too slow or too erratically. He would have done a background check. He would have convinced himself that this boy did not deserve Ren. There was nothing her father wouldn't do for her, but there were also things her father couldn't do for her. When she had gotten her period 2 years ago, the cramps had been so bad she'd told her dad she was sick and couldn't go to school. He held his hand to her forehead, dubious, because she didn't have a fever. "I have cramps," she told him flatly, and he went bright red and stumbled out of her room. He returned an hour later with two bags from CVS, Gatorade, Advil, a Matchbox car, a Rubik's Cube, a pack of bazooka gum, a little puzzle with a picture of a kitten. He set them on the foot of her bed as if he couldn't bring himself to get too close to her. "For your, lady stomach," he murmured. Seriously, how could she ask a man who couldn't even say the word cramps to bring her somewhere to get birth control? She had turned to her aunt for help, and it had almost cost Bex her life. It still might. In her sneaker, her cell phone vibrated. She crossed her ankles, wondering if anyone else had heard the buzz, knowing it was probably her dad. He would not let anything bad happen to her, even if she could not reach her phone and tell him she was all right. Sometimes when her father came home from work and was particularly quiet, Ren knew that he'd had a really shitty day. He once told her that being a detective meant you had to peel back the pretty of a town and see its festering wounds. Who was an addict? Who was beating his wife? Who was drowning in debt? Who was suicidal? But he never told her details. She had accused him once of treating her like a baby.
"It's not that I want to hide anything from you," he told her. "It's that if I tell you, you'll never look at people the same way."
Ren turned back to the nurse, and then to each of the other women. "I'm Ren," she whispered. "Izzy," said the nurse softly.
"And this is Dr. Ward."
The man lifted a hand, but that was all he could manage. The woman with a bruise on her forehead met her gaze. "Janine," she mouthed.
"Joy,"
whispered the woman in sweats. "What's he gonna—"
"Shh,"
Izzy hushed, as the shooter returned, dragging Olive from the closet and unceremoniously shoving her into the space beside Ren.
"Sorry, ma'am,"
he said to Olive, and then he pointed the gun at Ren's face. It was the second time Olive had come out of the closet, and it was equally traumatic. Now she glanced around the room. Ren was shaking like a leaf, her wrists bound. There were red marks on her skin where the gunman had yanked her out of their hiding spot. It was a wonder he hadn't dislocated the girl's arm. Seeing his roughness, Olive had been the most docile, subservient hostage imaginable as he hauled her out of the utility closet, too. She pleaded with him. What could a 68-year-old woman do to him, after all? And it had worked. Like most men, he saw only her petite frame and not the strength of her mind. He pushed her into a couch next to Wren, but he said, "Sorry, ma'am." And he didn't restrain her as he had Wren. Now her brain, her celebrated retired professor brain, was working in triple time to find a way out of this situation. He started waving the gun at Olive and Wren. It bounced between them with each syllable, like the little ball on the screen at a sing-along.
"Did you think you could hide from me? Did you?"
Olive was trying to be strong, really she was. Peg, her wife, was always the first to tell her she often worried herself into a panic about things that didn't come to pass. Like, for example, a mark on her shoulder that she was certain was a tick bite, heralding the onset of Lyme disease. It wasn't. A news report about another missile fired off by North Korea, which Olive thought would start World War III. It hadn't. "Eeyore," Peg would call her, and in this moment of all moments, the thought made Olive smile. "Well, Peg, I'm in a room with a crazy guy waving a gun and five other hostages. Is it all right to panic now?"
"You lied to me."
He turned, the force of his anger bending over the woman who was wearing scrubs. A nurse?
"You told me that closet was empty."
The woman cowered, her arms shielding her face. "I didn't..."
"Shut up! Shut your goddamn mouth!" he yelled.
In addition to Olive and Wren, there were three other women. There was a young woman in sweatpants, and another one with a big bruise on her temple. There was the nurse, whose name must have been Izzy, because the man she was tending to kept calling her that. The doctor, maybe? He was in scrubs, like her. He was big enough to take down the gunman, if not for the fact that his leg looked like hamburger below the thigh, and he was in obvious pain. Wren's aunt was nowhere to be seen. And then there was the gunman. He was middle-aged, maybe 40, maybe 45. He was wiry but strong, strong enough to haul a fighting teenager out of hiding. A silver stubble of beard rubbed along the coastline of his jaw. There was nothing about him that would have made Olive look twice at him on the street unless their eyes had met. Then she might have just stopped and stared. His eyes were almost colorless. His gaze felt like a sucking wound.
"I'm sorry," Olive said, in her thickest elderly southern lady accent. "I don't think we've been introduced. I'm Miss Olive." "I don't care who you are," he said.
One of the other women caught her eye and glanced at the television overhead, where the news was streaming in a weird metaphysical mirror. A reporter with this very clinic over his shoulder. "Gunman identified as George Goddard," a caption below read.
"Well, George," she said evenly, as if they were sitting down to lemonade.
"Lovely to make your acquaintance." He may have been unhinged, but he was from the South, where even the unhinged had mothers and grandmothers who drilled decades of manners into them. Olive did not believe in using her age except for discount prices on movie tickets and to get 10% off at Kroger the second Tuesday of the month. And now, apparently, in a hostage situation. George Goddard was sweating profusely, running his free hand over his brow and wiping it on his pants leg. Olive had a neuroscience background, but she could do armchair diagnosis with the best of them. Grandiose claims about the self, a sense of entitlement, lack of empathy, a tendency to lash out when they feel like they're not being respected. Narcissistic personality disorder, or homegrown terrorist, Olive thought. Either would fit. If you could see me, Peg, she thought. Olive was the one who peeked from between her fingers during scary movies, who still sometimes had to check the closet before going to bed to make sure there was nothing lurking inside. And goodness, after this episode, she would be doing that all the time. But here she was, calmly playing the old lady for all it was worth, the only postmenopausal one in the bunch. Surely he knew she hadn't come here to get an abortion. Did it even matter? The girl beside her burst into tears. Olive wrapped her arms around Wren, trying to will her strength. The man knelt down, his eyes clouding for a second.
Don't cry,
he said to Wren, his voice catching.
Please, don't cry.
He reached out to her with his free hand. There was something in the way he was looking at Wren, but wasn't seeing her, thought Olive. In his mind's eye, this was someone else. Maybe someone about her age who had come to this clinic against his wishes. After all, what else would have set him off? If Olive was right, and she usually was, what had happened to that other girl? She and Peg used to sit at the airport waiting for their flight and eavesdrop on conversations between men and women, mothers and children, colleagues. They would take turns making up backstories for them. He grew up in a cult and hasn't learned how to bond with someone in a healthy way. She's adopted that 5-year-old who has oppositional defiant disorder. That guy's a sex addict, cheating with his boss's wife.
Don't touch me!
Wren shrieked as the man reached out to her. She kicked reflexively, connecting with his knee, and he winced and backed away.
God damn it,
he growled, and he started toward her, but Wren let out a piercing scream. George covered his ears with his hands, his eyes screwed shut. Wren let a loud wail loose again, and another. Maybe she had figured out that her aunt was dead and she was inconsolable. Olive squeezed her arm. Clearly, every time Wren opened her mouth, it set the gunman on edge. She had to see that, even if she was young. Didn't she? Her weeping was almost rhythmic. And was Wren's foot buzzing? Wren turned to Olive, and Olive realized that in spite of her cries, not a single tear streaked down her cheeks. Her chin nodded imperceptibly to her sock, where a phone screen glowed beneath and vibrated with a text. She was covering up the sounds with her sobs. Olive waited until George paced past them, and then she covered Wren's ankle with her palm. She slipped her fingers beneath the elastic and felt around for the power button, turning it off. Wren sagged with relief, resting her head against Olive's shoulder. The movement made George spin around, the gun trained on her. Peg, I didn't even jump, she would say, when this was all over. Olive pasted a wide smile on her face. George, she said. I remember some Goddards from Biloxi. They were in the brick business, family run. You wouldn't be related now, would you? I do believe they moved to Birmingham, or was it Mobile?
Shut up, he growled. I should have left you in the goddamn closet. I can't think when you're yapping.
Olive quieted dutifully, and then she winked at Wren, because as George was busy silencing her, he had tucked the gun back into the waistband of his jeans. In the ambulance, Bex tried to speak.
My niece, she rasped, clawing at the shirt of the EMT.
Don't try to talk, the young man said.
He had soft eyes and softer hands, and his teeth were a beacon against his dark skin.
We're gonna take care of you now. We're almost at the hospital.
Ren.
When? He said, mishearing her. Soon, real soon.
He smiled down at her.
You got the devil's own luck.
What Bex knew was that this was not luck, but karma. If Ren did not get out of that clinic, Bex would never forgive herself. She should have known better than to go behind Hugh's back to the clinic. But Ren had come to her last week after school, riding her bike to Bex's studio. She had been finishing a new commission, a mural going into a skyscraper lobby in Orlando, to commemorate the Pulse shooting. It was a 14-by-14-foot profile of two men kissing. The pixels were made not of Post-its, as usual, but of photos of people who had died during the AIDS crisis.
Cool, Ren had said. What's it going to be?
Bex had explained it.
Want to help?
She gave Ren hundreds of tiny squares of tinted celluloid, showing her how to affix them to each photo with glue. Bex instructed her to start at the bottom and screen the last 10 rows of photographs in shades of violet celluloid. The next 10 rows above them would be blue, then green, then yellow, and so on. Standing far enough away, you would see the kiss, but you would also see a rainbow. Standing close, you'd see all the individual shoulders those two men had to stand on in order to embrace each other openly.
This isn't even a thing for kids your age, is it? Bex mused as they worked beside each other.
What thing?
Being gay.
Well, yeah, it still is, I think, if you're the one who happens to be that way. People assume you're cis and straight, so if you're not, you're different. But who says there's only one way to be normal?
Bex stopped working, her hands stilling over the lips of one of the models.
When did you get to be so smart?
Ren grinned.
What took you so long to notice?
They worked in silence for a while, and then Ren asked,
Does this piece have a name yet?
I was thinking maybe love.
That's perfect, Ren said, but not just the word, the whole sentence. Exactly the way you said it.
She brushed a line of glue around a violet celluloid.
Aunt Bex, can I ask you something? Do you believe that you can fall in love when you're 15?
Bex's hands stilled. She lifted the magnifying glasses she wore when she worked so that she could look Ren in the eye.
You bet I do, she said firmly. Is there something you want to tell me?
And oh, it had been delicious. The way Ren's cheeks had gone pink when she held his name in her mouth. How she talked about him as if there had never been another boy on earth. What love looked like was this, fledgling and unsteady, fierce and soft-shelled at the same time. Ren didn't have a mother around to talk to her frankly about sex. Hugh would have probably rather carved out his liver with a teaspoon than have that conversation with his daughter. So Bex asked her niece the questions no one else would. Have you kissed him? Have you done more than that? Have you talked about protection? No judgment, no finger wagging, just pragmatism. Once the rocket had left the launch pad, you couldn't bring it back. Ren was 15. She was writing his name on the leg of her jeans. She was stealing his sweatshirts so that she could sleep in the ghost of his scent. But she'd also been thinking of birth control.
Aunt Bex,
Ren had asked shyly. Will you help me? And so it was with the best of intentions that, once again, Bex had done something inexcusable. She heard a machine somewhere behind her start to beep. The EMT leaned closer. He smelled like wintergreen.
Ma'am, he said, try to relax.
Bex closed her eyes again, thinking of the bullet that had exploded through her, and the pierce of the scalpel that had maybe saved her life. This is what it means to be human, Bex thought. We are all just canvases for our scars. When Hugh's phone finally dinged, he lunged for it. But the text wasn't from Ren. It was from a guy named Dick, a state trooper who had been in his hostage negotiation training sessions. 2 hours ago, when George Goddard's license plate was run, Hugh had reached out to Dick, who got a search warrant from a local judge and let himself into the empty house in Denmark, Mississippi. Now Hugh had the results of Dick's search. A blurry photo of a handout about medication abortions that had the name and logo of the Women's Center on it. It was enough for Hugh to connect the dots from George to this clinic.
Where's the daughter? Hugh texted.
There was a beat, and then, M.I.A. Hugh raked his hair, frustrated by the fact that the only person he didn't want to talk to, his sister, refused to leave the site, and that the people he did want to talk to were not communicating. Ren, George Goddard, his missing daughter. Who the hell could negotiate when no one was listening? What was he missing now? What could he use that he hadn't used before? Hugh picked up the phone and texted Ren again. He dialed the number of the clinic, his secure line. One ring. Two. Three rings. Four. There was a click of connection, and then George's voice.
I'm busy, he said.
Muscle memory took over.
I won't take up too much of your time, George, Hugh replied. We were talking about your daughter when we got cut off. When you hung up on me. What about her?
Hugh closed his eyes and made a leap into the unknown. She wants to talk to you. Louis Ward knew exactly the moment that something in the shooter had changed. Even though he could only hear half the conversation, he could see that the man grew very still. Hope could do that to a person, Louis knew. Paralyze you, inside and out.
What about her?
The shooter said. When he, George, his name was George, according to the television still playing in the waiting room, said that, Louis realized two very important things. One, this was personal for him. Someone, a wife, a daughter, a sister, had had an abortion. Two, he wanted that someone's approval for today's actions. Izzy leaned down on the pretense of tightening his tourniquet. Her, she murmured.
Louis said. So I heard.
In the handful of times that the phone had rung over the past couple of hours, the people huddled in the waiting room had been able to take a collective breath. George didn't turn his back when he was on the phone. He wasn't that stupid. But he also didn't silence them if they whispered to each other.
You think it was his wife? Izzy whispered. Daughter, Louis grunted as he shifted and a streak of pain shot up his leg.
You have either of those? Louis shook his head.
I never wanted to make anyone else a target, he admitted. And eligible ladies don't often celebrate the fact that I spent the day looking into other women's vaginas.
Behind him, Janine shifted. You don't have to have a personal stake to know that it's wrong to kill an innocent baby. 88% of abortions happened in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, Louie knew, but the antis acted like those fetuses were already 8 pounds and holding their own bottles. Joy's eyes widened. You are not defending him, she said to Janine, after he knocked you out. I'm just saying, if it wasn't wrong, then there wouldn't be psychos like him. Izzy stared at her. That's the most ass-backward logic I've ever heard. Is it? You want to protect children with laws that punish rapists and molesters and murderers. Why is this any different? Because they're not children yet, Izzy said. They're embryos. They may not be born, but they're still human. Oh my God, Joy said. Shut her up before I do it myself. Janine folded her arms. I'm sorry, I know that he's insane, but you can't tell me there is ever a valid reason to destroy a child. Louis looked at her.
She's right, he murmured, and the others all stared at him. There is never a valid reason to destroy a child.
He thought of what he had seen over the years. The Syrian teen who needed to terminate after being raped as an act of war, but who couldn't get consent from her parents, who had been killed in the same war. The 16-year-old who had wanted to have an abortion at 8 weeks, whose parents stood in her way with their religion, and so her abortion was delayed for 6 weeks while she figured out how to get a judicial bypass and to raise the money to terminate. The 14-year-old who wanted to keep her baby, but was being pushed by her mother to have the abortion. A few years back, a 12-year-old girl came in who was 16 weeks pregnant. Her hysterical mother and stoic father were with her. She was quiet to the point of disengagement, clutching a tattered stuffed rabbit. She had said that a neighborhood boy got her pregnant, but during the intake process when she was alone with the counselor, she slipped up on her lie and revealed that the baby was her father's. The man was taken off by the police in handcuffs, but that girl, she still needed an abortion. While Louis performed the procedure, he talked to her. He told her,
This is not normal, what happened to you. This is not something you've done.
She didn't respond. She didn't act like a 12-year-old. She never had been allowed to be a 12-year-old. But he hoped that one day, when she was twice this age, she would remember the kindness of a man who hadn't hurt her. Now Louis turned to Janine.
What we do here, he said, what I do, sometimes it lets children be children.
Janine opened her mouth as if to argue the point, but then snapped it shut. Izzy tried to turn the conversation back to a safer spot. Well, whoever she is, wife or daughter, maybe she can convince him to let us go. From the couch further away came the voice of the girl, Ren, who could not have been much older than the child Louis had been remembering. Had she come here to get an abortion? Would they, in other circumstances, have met on the exam table? If he was my father, she muttered, I sure as hell wouldn't talk to him. For a moment, the only sound in the hospital room was the intravenous pump. Beth lay on her side, her face turned away from her public defender.
I wrapped it up, Beth whispered. I put it in the garbage. I didn't know what else to do.
She had bought misoprostol and mifepristone, the pills used in a medication abortion, off the internet. That was illegal in the United States, which Beth hadn't known at the time. Abortion clinics offered medication abortions to women who were up to 10 weeks pregnant, but they had to be administered in the clinic. Beth had been 16 weeks along and had taken the pills at home. The medication had done its job, but it had also caused enough hemorrhaging to land her in the ER. Tears slipped down the bridge of Beth's nose. For the first time since she had started talking, she looked at Mandy.
Miss DeVille? It wasn't a baby yet, was it?
Mandy's mouth tightened.
When I went to the clinic, Beth said, there was a woman outside who said my baby could feel pain.
The lawyer actually recoiled, and that only made Beth feel even worse. Mandy was an attorney, not a shrink. For all Beth knew, Mandy was against abortion and was only here to do her job. Didn't lawyers have to defend horrible people, murderers, rapists, all the time, no matter what they felt about them personally?
I'm sorry, Beth whispered. I haven't had anyone to talk to.
It's not true, Mandy said flatly. The pain thing. Beth came up on an elbow.
How do you know?
Science doesn't support it. I've done the research. Beth frowned, confused.
But you said you didn't even know anything about me before the arraignment.
I did the research, the lawyer repeated, for me. She leaned forward, her head bent, propped against the heels of her hands. I was 13 weeks pregnant, just at the point where you can tell people you're having a baby without tempting fate. My husband and I were at the ultrasound, she said. I wanted to name her Millicent if she was a girl. Steve said no little black girl is named Millicent. He wanted a boy named Obadiah.
Obadiah?
Beth repeated. Knock, knock, Mandy said.
Who's there?
Obadiah.
Obadiah who?
Beth played along. Obadiah Doryou. Mandy closed her eyes. Steve told me that joke, and then after that, everything went to hell. The technician came in and turned on the machine and started the ultrasound and just went white as a sheet. She shook her head. The doctor who came in wasn't my usual doctor. I remember exactly what he said. This fetus has a genetic abnormality inconsistent with life. Beth sucked in her breath. It was called holoprosencephaly. It happens when two sperm fertilize one egg at the exact same moment. There was a heartbeat and a brain stem, but the forebrain had never developed. If it survived birth, it would die within a year. Mandy looked up. I didn't want to terminate. I was raised Catholic.
What did you do?
Beth asked. I went online and looked up pictures of the babies who had it. It was horrible. She looked up at Beth. I know there are mothers who have kids with profound disabilities, and to see that as a blessing. It was kind of a wake-up call to admit to myself I wasn't one of them.
What about your husband?
Mandy looked up. He said it was a no-brainer. A laugh burst out of Beth. She clapped her hand over her mouth.
No, he didn't.
He did, Mandy nodded, smiling faintly. He did, and we laughed. We laughed and we laughed until we cried.
Do you have children now?
Mandy met her gaze. I stopped trying after the third miscarriage. Silence fell between them. Beth spun through another scenario, one in which she had been brave enough to tell her father she was pregnant. One in which she had carried the baby to term and given it to someone like Mandy.
You must hate me, Beth whispered.
For a long moment, Mandy didn't speak. Then she lifted her chin. I don't hate you, she said carefully. If you and I both told people our stories, even the most pro-life advocates would see mine as a tragedy. Yours is a crime. She thought for a moment. It's funny. The logic goes that as a minor, you can't exercise free will to consent because you don't have the mental capacity to do so. But in your case, the fetus is getting the protection you're not, as if its rights are worth more than your own. Beth stared at her. So what happens now? You're going to get discharged from the hospital in a day or so, and then you'll stay in custody until the trial. Beth's heart monitor began to spike.
No, she said. I can't go to jail.
You don't have a choice.
I never did,
Beth thought.
You're lying, George said. My daughter isn't here. Fuck that cop. He might be fishing for information, but that didn't mean George planned to give it to him. Yet now that Hugh McElroy had brought up his daughter, he couldn't stop thinking about her. Was Lil all right? Was she looking for him? Because she doesn't know what you're doing, Hugh said. Am I right? Lil knew that he loved her. He loved her so much that he had come here to make things right, even though it seemed impossible. George would never meet his grandchild. He just hoped this had not cost him Lil, too. How would she feel about you being here, George? He had not been thinking about that, clearly, when he came. He was just an avenging angel for her suffering, and he had been thinking of God's word, an eye for an eye, a life for a life. What's her name, George? Lil, he said, the syllable falling from his lips. That's pretty, Hugh said. Old school. George hated that he'd left her after they argued. He knew she'd be well taken care of in his absence, but he also knew he had fucked up. He'd just never been good with speeches. He didn't know how to say what he was feeling. Pastor Mike used to call him a man of few words, but reminded him that deeds spoke 1,000 times more loudly. That's why he was here, wasn't it? The drive here had been long, and his thoughts had provided the soundtrack for the journey. He had imagined Lil in all the incarnations of her life. The time she was a baby with croup, and he sat up with her all night in a steamy bathroom, the shower blasting hot water. The Father's Day when she tried to make him pancakes for breakfast and set a dish towel on fire. The sound of her voice harmonizing with his when they sang at church. Then he'd pictured himself like an Avenger, swollen to comic book hero proportions, bursting through the doors of the clinic and leaving destruction in his wake. He had imagined screams and falling plaster and a haze of dust. But somehow, although he could see himself when he started shooting, everything afterward was fuzzy. Revenge, in theory, throbbed with adrenaline and was clean with conviction. In reality, it was rushing into a house on fire and forgetting to map out your exit. Behind him, George heard a ripple of conversation. He turned around, the phone still clutched to his ear. Quiet, he ordered. What's going on in there? Hugh asked.
George ignored him, trying to focus on the scene in front of him. The women were whispering, and the baby killer he'd shot was still lying on the floor, a bandage twisted around his thigh.
Joy needs to use the bathroom, said the kid,
the one who'd scratched him. He glanced at her hands, making sure they were still tied.
Well, hold it in, he muttered.
The nurse who was kneeling on the floor looked up. It's not that, she said. She needs to check her pad. She just had a...
I know what she had,
George snapped, interrupting.
Is everything okay?
Asked the cop. There was a strange note in his voice.
a vibration. I have to go.
Wait,
Hugh said. George, I wasn't lying before. I didn't say your daughter was here. I said she wants to talk to you. She's listening to the news, George, and they don't get things right. They're not going to give your side of the story to her. Only you can do that.
Hugh paused.
I can make that happen for you. I can get her on the phone.
Wait, he muttered, distracted.
What's wrong, George? The cop asked. Talk to me.
He was staring at the television that had been on the entire time. When he first got here, there was some daytime food show on. But now there was a breaking news banner and a picture of a reporter with the clinic behind her. Her lips were moving, but the volume had been lowered. George couldn't tell what was being said.
What if Hugh was right? What if Lil was listening?
Where's the remote?
He asked.
When the women stared at him like he was crazy, was he? Or was he thinking clearly for the first time in hours? He barked at them again.
The remote!
The old lady pointed to a shelf near the television.
Get it,
he commanded. He was still holding the phone, but he had tuned out the cop's insistent voice. The old lady was fumbling with the control. She dropped it, picked it up, and pointed it at the television.
I think this is the right button, she said, but nothing happened.
Faster!
George yelled, and he jerked the gun at her. The woman screamed and dropped the controller again.
Leave her alone,
the kid cried.
George?
Hugh's voice blistered against his ear.
George, who was that yelling? Give her the damn thing, he ordered, pointing to the teenager. Kids always know how to work stuff like this. What kid? Hugh said.
George let the phone fall in his hand, holding it against his thigh, as the girl managed to increase the volume even with her wrists bound. Given that Goddard was, in fact, dishonorably discharged for killing civilians during his service in Bosnia. The screen cut to a studio anchor.
So we can say that there's a historical pattern of violence. Turn it off.
George breathed. He couldn't even see the screen. His vision was blurred, and all he could imagine was Lil listening to this utter bullshit.
That isn't what happened, he muttered.
He could feel the phone vibrating against his thigh, emitting sounds. Suddenly it was 2001, and he was in Bosnia, and he was doing his job, and everyone was out to get him. He thought of Lil hearing that bullshit. He thought of how when she was little, she would always play the princess and he had to be the prince who saved her from the ogre or the quicksand or the evil queen. She had never seen him as anything but a hero. And now? He reached for the nearest piece of furniture, a lamp, and hurled it against the wall. The women screamed. He could hear the cop yelling, trying to get his attention. He hung up the phone.
Well, fuck. They had his attention now.
Hugh held the phone in his hand, the line dead. He had heard two critical things in the background during this last phone conversation, Ren's voice and the television report on George's military service. He sank onto a chair and speared his hands through his hair, making it stand on end. When he was young, Bex was forever smoothing down his cowlicks. That's what it really came down to, wasn't it? Looking presentable to the world, no matter who you were when the cameras weren't rolling and the door was closed. When push came to shove, was he a hostage negotiator or a father? When the two came into conflict, which triumphed. He looked up, beckoning over a SWAT team member.
Where's Quant? He asked.
I can get him for you, Lieutenant.
The man hurried off and Hugh stared down at his makeshift desk, weighing his options. George Goddard was losing control. Hugh had heard Wren's voice. She was still alive, and this might be his only chance to keep her that way. A shadow fell over him, and Hugh glanced up to see Quant standing with his arms crossed.
I can only assume that the reason you want to see me is because you've come to your senses and you're ready for my men to move in, he said.
No,
Hugh replied. I want you to cut communications.
What? Why?
I don't want any comms in that building that don't come directly from us. I want the phone lines cut, except for the hard line to the clinic that connects to me. No TV signal, no Wi-Fi, nothing. I can't risk him seeing anything else on TV that will send him over the edge.
What if a hostage tries to communicate with us? Say one of them tries to use her cell.
I know what I'm doing, Hugh said firmly. He recognized the risks, but he also realized this decision would isolate George, so that the only information the shooter got was directly from Hugh himself. Quant looked at him for a long moment and then nodded. He walked off, shouting orders to his men, who would reach out to the cellular companies and cable company and effectively make the clinic an island. Hugh picked up his phone and texted Wren one more time, just in case she saw it.
Trust me, he typed.
Olive had been a professor for 35 years before she retired. Her course was on the workings of the brain, and it always had a waiting list. She started each semester by showing a random student a photo of himself or herself at an event or in a certain geographical place. After a few questions, the student was able to remember that moment and to fill in details. The catch? The student had been photoshopped into the picture and had never actually been there. Olive would explain to her students that the brain is constantly telling us lies. It simply can't record every detail that our eyes see, so instead, the occipital lobe adds what it assumes is there. The brain isn't a video recording, it's more like a photo album, and in between those pictures, it fills in the blanks. The result is that false memories can be created more easily than any of us want to believe. There will be incidents you swear on your mother's grave happened a certain way, but didn't. She wondered what she would remember of this incident. She hoped very little. With any luck, she would be granted a wondrous and selective amnesia. She hoped the same for all the others who were huddled in the waiting room, watching George fight with his own demons. And what of George, the shooter? What had his brain pieced together inaccurately, she wondered, to bring him here today? She raised her hand to her brow, surprised to see it come away bloody. When George had thrown the lamp against the wall, it had shattered, and ceramic and glass shards had gone everywhere, including, apparently, her temple. Let me, the nurse said. Izzy, that was her name. She pressed a piece of gauze against Olive's forehead, though they both knew it was nothing more than a scratch. We have to get out of here, Izzy murmured.
He's losing it.
Olive nodded. Oh, George, she said, pasting a wide, dizzy smile on her face. I hate to be a bother, but George, she waited until he looked up. I'm afraid that my age is getting the best of me. Some parts don't work as well as they used to. He blinked at her, confused. I have to pee, dear, she stated. At that, Izzy turned. If Olive is going to the restroom, then Joy has to go too. It's for medical reasons. I have an idea, Olive said. Why don't we all go now? If we get it out of the way, then we won't be any more trouble. At that, George snorted. A Hobson's choice. That was what she had to offer.